The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So welcome. For those of you who I've not met, my name is Andrea. And in the last few weeks, I've been talking about some of the things that kind of get in our way in the meditation practice, some of the states of mind that make it difficult for us. And actually not only in our meditation practice, but in our lives. These states are called the five hindrances. And they are defined as being those states that hinder or get in the way of our ability to concentrate, but they also get in the way of our well-being, of our sense of being able to meet experience as it comes, to be balanced and at ease around our experience as it is. And these five difficult states are sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, and doubt. And tonight I'd like to talk about ill will. The Buddha gave an analogy for ill will. He said that the way ill will obscures our experience is similar to the way if we have a bowl of water that we're trying to see our reflection in, that the ill will is like trying to see our reflection in that water when the water is boiling. And this brings in two qualities. There's the kind of agitation of the water that makes it difficult to see clearly. And then there's the heat, which is kind of the source of the agitation. And the ill will actually has both of these qualities. The quality of ill will has both this agitating quality and also often has a feeling of heat. It's like we're on fire. We're burning with the way we don't like something, the way we want to get rid of something, with a sense of feeling like this should not be this way. So the quality of ill will, partly the struggle that we have with it, is that we have a sense or a belief that our happiness depends upon our getting our way about this thing, either being able to get rid of it or somehow to control it or manipulate it or fix it or change it, such that our world is the way we want it to be again. So the difficulty that we have, actually the difficulty in our lives comes not so much from the fact that this thing exists in the world, but from our relationship to it. From the fact that we think in order to be happy, this thing has to change. This thing out in the world has to change, or the situation has to change somehow. So we harbor ill will towards people that we don't like. We actually can feel as if that, you know, there's something particular about that person that is threatening to us or feels somehow inappropriate. Or there may be actions that we don't like that people engage in. Maybe things that they do. It's not so much the person, but it's the things that they do, the way they leave the environment that creates the ill will. Or there can be situations that we have this sense of ill will around. The political situation or, you know, the situation with war in Afghanistan or something, that we just feel like this is just not the way it should be, and we harbor a resentment, a feeling of ill will around the situation, and perhaps about people who are somehow involved in the situation or perpetuating the situation. So there's many different kinds or flavors of ill will. The state of ill will actually includes several different mind states. It includes states such as anger or contempt or hostility. It also includes subtler states such as resistance, frustration, irritation. And it also includes things like fear as a form of ill will. So this ill will arising, the notion that there's something out there that needs to change, this reflects our kind of basic misunderstanding about our relationship to the world and where our happiness comes from. We have this kind of understanding or misunderstanding that the things out there need to be in line with the way we want them to be in order for us to be happy. We think we have to like our situation out there in order to be happy. And what the practice is, or what we can begin to explore, is whether it's possible to alter our relationship with the experience, since it's actually our relationship that's the source of our struggle. And we think it's the thing out there, but it's actually our relationship to the experience that is the actual source of our struggle. So this doesn't mean, I want to say this right up front, this doesn't mean that we should not try to change the environment if we find, for instance, injustice in the world or we see somebody harming somebody else. This doesn't mean that we just sit back and say, oh, well, I need to adjust my relationship with this experience. But what it does mean is that often when we see something happening in the world that we want to fix or change or alter in some way, something that we don't like, our typical movement is to act out of that dislike. We act out of an aversion, out of an anger, out of a frustration or a hostility, in order to change or fix that thing. Very often in our response to something that we don't like, our action comes out of this hardness of heart. And that hardness of heart is actually one of the things that makes us feel disconnected from the world. It makes us feel separate. It makes us feel that things aren't right, this kind of hardness of the heart. And so what I'm proposing is that it's possible in finding something that seems like there's injustice or something that needs to be changed in the world, that it's possible to act out of, not out of anger or aversion, not out of that ill will, but actually to act out of compassion. Compassion can be a motivating source for us to make change in the world as opposed to anger. And that actually involves quite a shift in our experience and in our perceptions, to shift from that hostile viewpoint to this compassionate viewpoint. So part of this practice has to do with letting go of the hostility around the thing that we want to change. Letting go of the needing, in effect, the needing to have it change. But still, that doesn't mean just sitting back like a lump on the log and saying, oh, just things as they are, just meet things as they are. There is a place for compassionate action. Compassion itself almost demands action. So exploring that in our relationship to things that we don't like. So in our meditation and in our daily lives, it's really helpful to get familiar with this feeling. Getting familiar with the feeling of ill will itself. The Buddha recommends several ways to explore and to work with the hindrances. Three basic aspects. One, recognize what it feels like, recognize its presence, then recognize its absence or its disappearance, and then also recognizing the ways that it comes into being and disappears. So the kind of the way it's formed, the way it's created. And so I'd like to talk about each of those and how we can explore looking at this quality of ill will from each of these perspectives. So the first, recognizing that this quality of ill will is present, this quality of aversion. Basically, this is about getting to know what it feels like, getting to know the different ways that it can feel. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, there are many different flavors of ill will. There can be kind of two rough ways that it can feel. It can feel like a lashing out of a wanting to get rid of something, you know, to push away or to kind of that lashing out, the quality of anger, essentially. That can be one manifestation of ill will. It can also feel like a recoiling inwards out of revulsion or disgust, for example. Or a recoiling away out of fear. So learning to recognize the different flavors of ill will. I'm going to read a list of different flavors because sometimes it's helpful to just hear the range that a particular difficult state of mind can operate in. And these are in no particular order. Anger, bitterness, resentment, hostility, dislike, rage, irritation, annoyance, worry, hatred, distrust, cruelty, discontent, frustration, aversion, dissatisfaction, contempt, disdain, fear, apprehension. There's a wide range, both in kinds and in kind of levels, going from just irritation to full-blown hostility, from frustration to rage. One of the ways that we can recognize ill will is by getting familiar with the stories that it tells, with the thoughts that go along with it. You know, sometimes that's how we can actually recognize it, to get familiar with the ways that our mind is thinking. So, for instance, this story of aversion. Not this. I don't like this. how can I get rid of this? And just that basic story of pushing away, of aversion. The story of fear is something along the lines of, what if this thing happens? What if this bad thing happens? There's often, with fear, there's usually a projection into the future, a thinking about something in the future that we are afraid of. So there's the future thinking and the sense that if that thing happens, it will be bad. Anger, the most kind of obvious flavor of anger, something like, you done me wrong, you done me wrong. Other, maybe something like self-righteousness, is like, I'm right, you're wrong. That kind of flavor of anger. Or there can be a kind of just an excessive, there can be an excessive replay of the past in anger, often. You know, of playing over a story over and over again. They shouldn't have done that. They shouldn't have done that. They shouldn't have done that. Or of playing it over. Here's what I should have done differently. That kind of thing. So getting familiar with the stories, the particular flavors of ill will that you tend to come into contact most frequently. Each of us may have a particular one. It might be frustration, it might be anger, it might be a fear. Recognizing which flavor is most common for you and then getting familiar with it, learning to recognize it. One technique or tool of the meditation practice that's really helpful with recognizing the presence of ill will is to use what's called the noting practice. The noting practice is it's a tool where we actually use a very soft mental name in our minds that reflects what we are experiencing in the moment. And that noting, generally, you're encouraged with that noting to see if you can keep the noting light and kind of easy, so that if you're experiencing anger, for instance, the note wouldn't be like, anger, anger. It would be more like, anger, anger. So that the tone of the note is helpful in terms of bringing a little bit of balance of mind around the meeting of that experience. Now this tool, I mean, it sounds very, very simple and maybe even silly, but there's been some research done actually that kind of explains why this works. The emotional component of ill will or anger or any emotion is kind of in the lower brain. It's in the limbic system. And the noting is happening in the neocortex. And so it kind of brings in a different area of the brain. It kind of mediates the experience through this different part of the brain, and it seems to allow the emotional storm that's happening in the limbic system to settle down through this just gentle naming of experience. So it's a very powerful tool, and you don't actually have to know much more than that, actually. In my early days of practice, I knew very little about paying attention to the body, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute, or other tools for being mindful of difficult emotions. But I pretty much just recognized and met, oh, Okay, well, this is anger. Okay, wow, what? This doesn't feel good. Oh, anger. Anger is happening. Anger is happening. That's another good way to phrase it in a note, as opposed to, I'm angry. Anger is happening. This is just a process that's happening in this moment. It's a kind of a powerful way to reframe it in our minds. Anger is happening. And just that, just recognizing and acknowledging, oh, this is happening in the present moment, really powerful way to create some space around that difficult experience. So aside from learning to recognize it, first of all, just learning to recognize when it's present and meeting it, naming it, the practice with mindfulness is to actually get familiar with it. What does this experience of being in the state of ill will feel like? What is it like to be a person that feels ill will, that feels anger or frustration or fear or rage or cruelty? What does that feel like? So again, we typically are focused outwards on the world, trying to figure out how to manipulate the world. And this involves a turning around, 180 degrees turning around to pay attention to not what out there in the world is wrong, but what is the feeling of this experience? What does ill will feel like? And in particular, it's really helpful to pay attention to the experience in the body. For a couple of reasons. One, because a lot of the whipping up of the storm of ill will comes through our thinking process. Those stories that I was talking about earlier. When we continue on the cycle of those stories, you done me wrong, you done me wrong, you done me wrong, in all the different ways we say that to ourselves, it just whips up the anger, whips up the frustration, whips up the rage. If we can take our attention out of the thoughts and turn to the bodily experience, it takes a lot of the fuel out of the ill will. A lot of the fuel for our ill will. It's like every time we think those thoughts, he shouldn't have done that. It's like throwing another log on the fire. Yep, shouldn't have done that. Let's add another log to that fire. When we stop adding logs to the fire and just watch the fire burn, it eventually burns out. And it doesn't feel good. I mean, I have to say that. This is a practice that takes, it's an acquired taste, I'll have to say. It's an acquired taste. You learn how to turn your attention to the body and pay attention to that burning feeling, that feeling of pressure, that feeling of aching, that feeling of contraction, that feeling of hardness and pressure. The acquired taste aspect of it is that we start to see over time, we start to recognize that as we turn our attention to the experience in that way, that it is the movement towards the ending of that experience. We do start to see it burn itself out. So we see that this turning towards is supportive of that state letting go. And that acquired taste is the kind of joy or the happiness or the peace that comes in knowing this is heading in the direction towards peacefulness. And it can actually feel that way in the moment, even just that shift of instead of kind of being consumed by the state of ill will, having a little bit of distance from it and just watching it. And instead of, you know, being consumed, we're just observing. That little bit of space can make the whole experience shift a little bit. And this is actually a movement of insight in a way. It's kind of a perspective change. The perspective changes on the experience, and we're no longer so identified with that experience. A lot of the pain around that kind of experience when we turn to it is the fact that we're identified with it. We feel like this is me, and because I feel this way, it means I'm a bad person, and I shouldn't be feeling like this. If we can just watch it as a phenomenon and not be so identified with it, which what this is what the mindfulness begins to encourage. The lessening of that identification really shifts our relationship to the experience. And it's not so much a problem anymore. And that shift also seems to allow the burning out of that fire to happen more more easily. It comes more naturally. So very helpful to pay attention in the body. Very, very helpful to turn the attention. Turns our attention to the present moment experience of the ill will without being caught into fueling the fire. So another aspect that the Buddha recommends around paying attention to this state of mind, he says, and this sounds perhaps a little contradictory, he says, when you are, you know, paying attention to this quality, recognize when it is not present. This is particularly helpful when you have a state of ill will that you kind of strongly identify with. So you feel like, for instance, frustration is always just below the surface. That there's almost never a time that there's not frustration. Whenever you look for it, there it is. So there's a sense of it being really deeply enmeshed with who I am. What we begin to recognize as we turn our attention both to the experience of that frustration is we recognize actually, as we get really familiar with the feeling of frustration, we actually start to recognize that it's not always there. There are moments when it's not there. And this recognition begins to poke holes in that belief that it is always there. And that it is really who I am, that it is me. So the practice of recognizing when it's not there is actually quite helpful. But usually that's hard to do until we've really become familiar with the state itself. When we really become familiar with it, then we begin to recognize, oh, actually it's not always there. I'm free of it more than I thought I was. So freedom from ill will is an analogy given for freedom from ill will is likened to being free from illness. I think this is an interesting analogy, that when we are ill, you know, the food that nourishes us doesn't taste very good, we don't want to eat, we don't have much energy. So when we get well again, we have the energy back. We are nourished again by the food that we eat, by the wholesome food that we eat. So ill will likened to being free from illness. And when we're in the state of ill will, we're caught by the things that drag us down in a way. It's hard to feel nourished by beautiful qualities of mind such as loving kindness or generosity or happiness. We're so caught and dragged down by the state of ill will that we can't connect with these things that nourish us in a beautiful way. So recognizing when this state is absent and recognizing if it does have that quality of feeling like you have let go of an illness, the last aspect has to do with recognizing conditionality, recognizing what causes ill will to come into being, what causes it to vanish, and essentially what are the conditions that would support it not coming into being? And what things support the opposite of ill will, in effect? And I'll actually read this section just to give you a flavor of the Buddha's words. He says, she understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen ill will, how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen ill will, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned ill will. Now that last one sounds really complicated, but it is basically those three pieces that I talked about. So how there comes to be the arising of unarisen ill will is what creates, can we see ill will coming into being? What is the situation that creates or causes it in our minds? How does it come to be? Now we may, as we start to pay attention to ill will, just recognizing when it's present, just becoming familiar with the ill will itself, this exploration begins to reveal how the conditionality of ill will works. So you don't actually have to do anything different in the mindfulness to start to see this. You just have to be willing to meet the ill will over and over and over again from many different times, many different angles, just kind of the willingness to meet it over and over again begins to show us how it comes to be in our minds. So, for example, you might notice that ill will comes to be when, you know, you're sitting there minding your own business and a thought pops into your mind of a friend, and then you remember that that friend did something that hurt you. And then you start thinking about that, and then you start getting angry about that. Now, that may take no more than a split second in your mind for that thought to come in, the memories to come in, the anger to boom. It happens. So just being willing to watch ill will, what starts to happen actually is we're willing to hang out with it. At least in my experience, I spent quite a bit of time in my first few years of practice, and particularly in the first few months of my practice, paying attention to anger. It was the state of mind that got me into this practice in the first place. It was out of control, and I was having trouble functioning because I was so angry. And so I started this process by just recognizing when the anger was present, just noticing it, just being with it, just recognizing it. Okay, anger. Yep, anger's here. And then over time, it's as if just that willingness to be with the anger began to kind of it's kind of like the mind began to recognize it before it became strong anger. Kind of like the mindfulness was attuned to the smell of anger coming, just through that willingness to meet it over and over again. And so after a while of paying attention to that anger, I began noticing that I wasn't in such a full-blown rage. You know, that it wasn't making me non-functional anymore because I was recognizing it before the mind got out of control. And that itself was a huge benefit. That was a huge benefit in my life, that I was no longer finding myself sitting frozen in front of my keyboard, enraged, not able to even think. So the process of just bringing the mindfulness really supported that. It's like the mind began to recognize, I didn't have to do it, the mind began to recognize how it was getting there. So it started to recognize the earlier in the process. And then one day, and I've told this story before, some of you have probably heard this story, one day I was in my kitchen and, you know, just hanging out, chopping an apple, and, you know, nothing particularly going on, but I must have been relatively mindful just in that space, because in the chopping of the apple, I saw a memory appear, a memory of the person I was angry with. There was a connection between the memory and the apple. I was with that person at a fruit stand. And then I noticed that there was this impulse or this inclination to jump on that thought and think more thoughts in order to get angry. I was not angry in that moment, but there was a strong impulse in that direction. In seeing that impulse in that direction, the mind kind of said, I don't think so. You know, I didn't have to do anything, actually. The mind seeing where it was headed, if it went that way, it was headed into that burning, painful experience of anger. It kind of let go of it. It just let go of it. The mind let go of it. And I actually stood there waiting to get angry because I had not had the experience of this person coming up into my mind and anger not coming up into my mind. And when I didn't get angry, that's when I really knew how powerful this practice is. So we can actually witness through mindfulness. And this actually, all of this that I describe happened in my daily life. It was not even on the meditation cushion that I saw this. The ability of our minds to meet experience, to just watch and witness and learn from that witnessing, not having to try to figure it out, not having to try to think, well, what are the causes? How does this come to be? We don't have to do that. All we need to do is meet the experience over and over again, and the mind will educate itself and understand itself how that suffering is created. So, seeing how it's constructed is very powerful. Realizing, recognizing what causes it to vanish is powerful. In this case, this example that I just gave, the recognition of that movement towards the anger was what actually allowed it to let go. It was that recognition plus the preceding months of having spent time recognizing, oh yeah, this is anger. Yep, boy, this is unpleasant. Really getting familiar with what anger actually feels like, the suffering of the anger itself. You know, when we're angry at somebody, when we have ill will towards somebody, so often we're directed outwards and thinking, how can we harm them? Or, you know, it's like we want to harm them somehow. And we believe in some way, at least I did, I recognized at some point that I believed that the anger that I was experiencing would somehow cause the person that I was angry with to feel suffering. And this particular situation, it kind of quickly became obvious to me that it wouldn't happen because I was in the middle of the South Pacific and he was in California. So, you know, 7,000 miles separated us and probably wasn't going to travel over the ocean, that anger. So we have that belief. And so turning outwards to with that feeling of this anger is going to hurt that person, there can be a kind of a sense of, yeah, they deserve to feel that pain. And we're so focused on wanting to cause them some kind of suffering that we're not seeing that we're suffering at the same time already. You know, actually, before any harm could be done to the other person, we've already suffered. And so that those months of recognizing the actual pain that anger caused me, that suffering that it created in here, was a big part of how that letting go happened. Because when the mind saw that it was headed in that direction, it remembered what it was like to head that direction. And that's why it could let go. It knew that way lies suffering. That allowed that anger to actually never come into being, that particular anger. So this kind of understanding around the causes and conditions, how it comes into being, how it vanishes, this is likely to happen just through the meeting of experience, just being willing to meet over and over again. I sometimes like to use the analogy of data gathering. I think I used this before in the last few classes, of that while we're observing our experience, we're kind of functioning like a naturalist, observing the processes at play in our minds. Anger, ill will, frustration, fear, these are processes at play in our minds. If we can have the attitude of a naturalist exploring those processes, again, it takes the identification out of it a little bit. We become, it's a kind of a skillful identification in effect with the observer. And that's a little bit more of hopefully a little more balanced perspective than from in the midst of the anger. So I have just a couple more things to say, but I'm going to stop because I want to leave some time for discussion. So anything that you'd like to offer, or questions or comments?
So you mentioned that your anger made you non-functional. I had actually almost the opposite experience with anger, where it made me, where I felt empowered. Mm-hmm. I felt invigorated and energized. And it, at first when I noticed, when I had so much anger, it was kind of wasted. I was just kind of, just think, and it just drove me mad. But I learned to channel it into my present activity, take that energy and channel it. And it made me very, very effective at whatever I was doing, because it gave me this passion for whatever I was doing. Because mm-hmm. I realized, well, it's not going to help to think about this and worry about this. I might as well do what I can do, act on what I can.
Right.
So I'm curious about your thoughts about that, because I guess when you said throwing logs in the fire, I actually nurtured that anger because I found it so effective that uh-huh. I put more logs in the fire, and eventually I ran out of logs, but it kind of dissipated it anyway over time. But, uh-huh. But it gave me this energy while I had it, but I also suffered, I think, along the way for it.
Yes. Yeah, it is true. I mean, anger brings energy, and that's part of its appeal, in a way. I mean, I spent a lot of time exploring anger, not just early in my practice, but it was one of my very strong patterns. And one thing I really saw that kind of shocked me, actually, when I first, when anger first was arising, often the experience of anger is a feeling of suffering. It's unpleasant. But the initial hit as that anger arose was one of invigoration. It was one of warmth and aliveness, you know, and it quickly turned into really strong unpleasantness. So that rising of energy is a part of the anger, and the we can channel it. It actually can be skillfully channeled. That's where we need to take care in our, what are we cultivating? So, you know, the anger can rise, and we can use that anger towards a compassionate purpose. And we can, in that, I mean, so, there can be mixed motivations, and it sounds potentially like there may have been some mixed motivations there. You were throwing on the logs in order to generate the energy, is my guess, actually, that it was the energy that was helpful more than the anger.
Yeah, I didn't care about whatever I was angry about anymore. It was just that I found it was so much energy it gave me, and just... I would get a little bit angry, and I'm like, okay, great, I got some more, and now I can go back to
it. Yeah, and that's something to look at, actually. You know, if you're counting on anger to give you energy to do something, you might want to see, can you find something else to connect with? Can you find compassion to connect? Compassion comes with just as much energy towards doing an action as anger does, I think. I mean, you know, that there's that... That the compassion comes with a real strong motivation to act. So, you know, you might want to play with where, you know, see if you can think thoughts, kind of revise the thoughts a little bit, those logs that you're throwing on, you know, about rather than being angry about, well, I don't know what your situation is, but, you know, potentially rather than being angry about what somebody is doing to someone, thoughts about how helpful you can be to that person, you know, to kind of fuel the fire of compassion instead of the fire of anger. But yeah, I mean, it does bring that energy, and it's very interesting to notice that kind of dependence that we have. You know, we assume that, you know, that the anger towards doing, the energy towards doing comes from anger sometimes, you know, as opposed to that it can come from these more beautiful places.
I guess it also kind of fizzles out too. It's something I had to keep nurturing in order to get that energy back.
Mm-hmm.
But I find compassion is something that sort of grows and becomes more powerful over time as I nurture.
Yes.
It.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, behind you.
In terms of the conditions that give rise to anger, one thing that I've noticed is that anger can become a conditioned response to fear. And that, as you mentioned, in the present moment, it actually feels really good. We like it, and we can tend to cling to it. And so it occurs to me that it can be kind of a foundational type of clinging. And just being aware of that, it can be... So whenever we are afraid in any situation... we tend to get angry. It becomes a conditioned response, and just becoming aware of that can enable us to maybe change.
Exactly. Becoming aware of how you respond. Because some people respond to fear through more fear. You know, it kind of spirals into more and more fear. Some people respond to fear through, I can do something about this. I'm going to take action here. And, you know, that kind of sense of having some control through that path or channel of anger feels invigorating and feels good to feel like we have control. So noticing your own patterns is really the power behind mindfulness, to see, oh, I see when I get afraid, I get angry, to kind of just see that link between those two over and over again, see that link. And actually in seeing the link between those two, you might then start to see what is it that makes the fear arise? And then that might start to fall apart. So, you know, just so keep exploring your own habitual patterns is the most I can encourage you. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I was thinking about resentment. And what I've noticed is it often is like a hook to the past. It's like something that hasn't been resolved. Or it's just, sometimes it's just like a perpetual... not perpetual, that it's always there, but sort of like a similar response in a situation.
So you're saying that there's the kind of replay of the past.
It arrives. Let's say someone disses you or something like that, and this person has done that before. Okay, so rather than just being present for what's happening now, all the old...
With that person, you mean?
With that
If that person's
person,
there,
yeah.
Okay, then yeah. It's like that person is calling up the fact that they dissed you, and you're seeing them through that filter.
Right, so there's like this, I call it like an unresolved situation, but it keeps coming up, and even though I know that it's a hook... and then I pay attention to my body and what's present, it still has a lot of energy. So that it's like the present situation sometimes gets taken over by the past.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk briefly about that?
One thing I'll just mention, there is work to do in terms of letting go of the past and actually being able to meet what is actually here. But, you know, sometimes anger, resentment is a signal that something needs to be attended to. You know, it can mean that. It can be a signal that something does need to be, I don't know if it can actually be resolved. You can't change the past. But, you know, you may find, you know, particularly if the situation comes up over and over again, you know, this person disses you once a week or something.
No, the situation I was thinking of, it hasn't happened for a while,
uh-huh.
But something similar happened maybe a couple of years ago. And all of a sudden, it's like I'm remembering all the other times rather than just this one.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know, and then the mind does what the mind does. You know, and it's similar each time what the mind does with this kind of reaction.
Right. So are you saying that it's with different people?
No, I'm specifically looking at this one person.
Okay, so there have been multiple times with this person. It's very helpful to notice the reactivity in your own mind and to see if you can, you know, I often use the analogy of taking the lenses off. I mean, essentially when you're looking through that lens of resentment, it's like you've got these colored lenses on. And can you... at the very least, know that you're looking through those colored lenses and maybe be able to actually take them off and look at them instead of through them, you know, to be able to recognize, okay, this is the field or the flavor of resentment. But again, you know, there may actually need to be something that, you know, some action that you might need to take, like, you know, talking to that person about how they've behaved.
Which I have done.
Mm.
There's also a thing about accepting that this is sometimes the way that this person is.
Yeah, exactly.
And also
yes.
The choice of wanting a relationship or not wanting a relationship. But the thing is that when that kind of resentment comes up, sometimes it still takes a while to...
So you might want to notice what you're hanging on to. Because it's about you're hanging on to something.
Wanting to be liked.
Okay. Yeah. That's a potent thing to come into contact with.
And so, like, the piece is... well, not everyone's always going to like you or do what you do. So, you know, can you just let it go?
Right.
But sometimes it's easier. And the thing is when these old ones come, there's still that hook in them, even though, you know.
The old ones, you know, this is something to really be interested in, that when the old ones come up, because, you know, there's the memory that comes up, and the hook, as you're calling it, is a separate event. You know, that there's the memory, and then there's something about either believing or viewing or, you know, judging that memory that's happening in the present moment. It's actually being created in the present moment. That hook is happening in the present moment. It doesn't feel that way. It feels kind of like that memory comes up with all of its baggage altogether. But they're actually separate phenomena. That memory of, oh, that person said that to me 2 years ago, that's just something that is just a thought arising in the mind. And then there's the leaping onto it and believing that it means something. And that's a separate event. So to begin to see that the entire process of that resentment is actually being created here and now.
Thank you. The piece about the belief is very...
So we need to stop.